Yeah, so I work in the sort of an area that's described here as quantum foundations. And so we're sort of concerned with the sort of conceptual and mathematical structure of quantum theory. One question that people in quantum foundations have always been especially interested in is trying to give an interpretation of quantum theory. So give a sort of an account of what the world is really like, what reality is like right at the bottom if quantum theory is true. So there's been lots of work on providing different interpretations. So you may have heard of the many worlds interpretation. This is the idea that the wave function, you know, just evolves unitarily. Every time it goes into a superposition, the universe splits into two copies, one having one set of things happening, the other having the other set of things happening. There's something called the pilot wave model, where you have the wave function evolves, and there are, in addition to the wave function, there are actual particles with having positions that get pushed around by the wave function in accord with some equations. There's another set of interpretations called collapse models, where the wave function evolves, but whenever the wave function starts to have a superposition of something macroscopic being in one state or another, so a pointer, for example, pointing here or here, then the dynamics of the equations cause the wave function to collapse. So you just get one thing happening or the other. So the cat is either alive or dead. And there are other interpretations. And people have been debating this for a very long time. You know, I went into the field myself in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and I went to conferences, and it was all very exciting. And then, you know, 10, 15 years later, I was going to conferences where people were debating the same things, the same kinds of talks, the same issues. And as far as I could see, no really substantial progress had been made. I mean, the problem is that you have lots of sort of dead ends, lots of interpretations, which are all good and fine by themselves, but they don't lead anywhere. They don't lead to new physics. So some of us started taking a different point of view. I think we were primarily motivated by Chris Fuchs, who's currently here at the Institute. And the point of view instead was to think of trying to reconstruct quantum theory from some deeper postulates or principles or axioms. So if you look back in history, there are lots of examples of this kind of thing. You know, there were the Kepler's laws of planetary motion. If you look at those laws of motion, they're kind of ad hoc. It's not clear why the planets would obey those particular laws. In some sense, so that they were empirical laws that had been discovered. And then Newton came along a bit later and showed how those Kepler's laws followed from some very natural laws, his laws of mechanics and his law of gravitation. And then something similar happened again towards the end of the 19th century, I guess. It was realized that Maxwell's equations were invariant under not Galilean transformations, but Lorentz transformations, which seem rather odd. And these were a rather ad hoc looking set of transformations, mathematically very ad hoc. Why on earth would these fundamental equations of physics be invariant under this mathematically rather strange set of transformations? But then Einstein came along later and showed, well, actually, if you have two very natural postulates, that the speed of light is the same, is independent of the speed of the source, and that physics is the same in all reference frames, then you can derive the Lorentz transformations. So somehow much greater insight was provided into the origin of these transformations. So that's nice. And the idea is of reconstructions in the context of quantum foundations is perhaps we can do something similar for quantum theory. So if you look at quantum theory as it stands, it's a sort of theory, you know, a sort of rather mathematically presented theory. States are represented by operators on a Hilbert space. You have unitary evolution, various the Born rule for calculating probabilities. It's a very mathematically presented theory. And it's a bit similar to the Lorentz transformations. They were very mathematical. It wasn't clear where they came from. Likewise, it's not clear where the rules of probability come from. Sorry, the rules of quantum theory come from. And it would be nice if we could give a set of simple principles from which we could derive the mathematical structure of quantum theory. So that's the idea of reconstruction in quantum foundations. And I like to think of it as trying to set the debate spinning about a different axis, rather than thinking about interpreting quantum theory. So people who interpret quantum theory usually take the equations as given and simply try to put a particular interpretation on them. Rather than thinking in those terms, perhaps we can try to simply account for where the equations of quantum theory come from, so to reconstruct them from some more deeper, postulates. And if we do that, perhaps we can gain a deeper understanding. Okay, so that's the basic idea of reconstructions, which has been a substantial amount of my research in recent years. Any questions on that issue? That's clear. Okay, so if you're going to be involved in trying to reconstruct quantum theory, you better think about what kind of theory quantum theory is. And when you think about it, quantum theory is really a kind of meta theory. It's a sort of set of axioms that apply to many different physical situations. So you could have a particle in a box. You could have the spin degrees of freedom of some particles. You have photons. It's always the same mathematical apparatus. You have Hilbert spaces describing systems. So we better be careful not to try and derive quantum theory from some principles or postulates that only pertain to one of those physical situations, because then it wouldn't be an explanation of where quantum theory came from, because quantum theory applies to a whole broad class of situations. It's really a meta theory. Quantum theory is really a bit like classical probability theory. Classical probability theory can be applied to dice. It can be applied to to particles in a box, to any number of different things. Quantum theory, likewise. Basically, you could call quantum theory quantum probability theory. It's a meta theory that applies to a whole range of different situations. So we have to bear that in mind. We shouldn't be looking for postulates that are particular to a given physical situation. The next thing is, when I said that Einstein derived the Lorentz transformations from two postulates, he was already taking for granted quite a lot of structure. So he had space and time as continuous parameters. He had global inertial reference frames. He took all this structure for granted. And if we're going to derive quantum theory from some set of postulates, we're going to likewise need some kind of framework within which to apply our postulates. So that's a key point. And a lot of the work is really developing that framework, so that you can then apply the postulates within that framework. It may subsequently turn out that certain assumptions behind that framework itself are wrong, and we have to give them up. If you look at special relativity, well, the assumption of the existence of a global inertial reference frame turned out to be wrong. But it wasn't stated as one of Einstein's postulates. It was part of the background set of assumptions. So the idea, the sort of framework that I'm interested in is what I would call a sort of general probabilistic a framework for operational theories which is sort of probabilistic in a sort of general sense. It's a sort of generalized class of probability theories. So here's the idea. First of all, so what do I mean by operational? What I mean by operational is, when we go into a laboratory and we look at an experiment, we have to describe the experiment. Okay. And usually, we do something schematic, like we say, well, there's a box, and a ray comes out here, and it goes in here, another ray comes out here, and we perform the measurement, something like this. So we're describing the experiment in terms of boxes and how they're connected to each other. So this is a kind of operational account. It's in terms of the experimental apparatuses themselves. So what I want is, I want, first of all, an operational level of description. So I'm going to think, think carefully about what kinds of experiments we're interested in when we do quantum, when we apply quantum theory to the experimental world, and how to describe them. And then, having done that, well, it's not enough. If you want a physical theory, it's not enough merely to describe the world. You have to make some predictions as to what happens. And the way we do that in quantum theory is by adding probabilities. So add. We need to add probabilities. So it's kind of a two-stage process. First of all, we have this operational level of description, and then we add in the probabilities. Okay. So I'll tell you about the kind of operational level of description. So the idea is that we start with operations. So here's a box. You can have some particles going into it, some particles coming out of it, perhaps different types of particles. Then in addition, on this box, you may have some settings, like some knobs that you adjust, and then you may have some classical outcome. So you may have a light flashes, red or blue or green. So if it flashes red, that's one particular outcome. Okay. And I call this thing an operation. This is basically one use of an apparatus. So it could be, for example, a lens or a detector or a laser or something like this that you use in the context of an experiment. Any questions still? No? Okay. And now we start to wire these things together. So there's two operations wired together. What that corresponds to is you're aligning the aperture. So this thing has some aperture coming out of it. Maybe this is I don't know what it would be, a one output of a beam splitter. And you're sending it into another box. This could be another beam splitter or something like that. Some element of an experiment in quantum theory. And you could, so this thing is a wire. It represents aligning two of these boxes. So the particle can go from here to here. And you could continue doing that and have, something like this. And if you close this off, so there's no wires left open at the end, it's just, then I call that a circuit. And so I call this general framework, I call it the circuit framework. And it's a very versatile framework. It can describe a lot of different experimental situations. Certainly, if you go into a quantum optics laboratory and look at the experiment, you can describe typically an experiment of that nature by this framework. And probably a lot more besides. I think it's not a completely general framework for describing any experiment. In particular, I think it's not versatile enough to describe, say, an experiment to test general relativity. But it's good enough for the sorts of situations where you apply quantum theory. Okay. So once you've got this framework, you can start to look at it, have more structure. So, for example, something like this, where I have just open wires coming out to the future. I should perhaps have said that. These are sort of going out to the future. These are coming in from the past. So time is kind of going in that direction. So
by wires, do you mean particles?
For example. Yeah, you could think of these wires as corresponding to where the particles move between the boxes.
Is that diagram like a tensor diagram?
This one?
which represents a probability? All the lines are closed off.
That turns out to be, well, so this diagram actually represents, is a description of an experiment. It's not a mathematical object. It's a description of an experiment. But it ends up being very closely related to a tensor diagram that gives a probability. And indeed, maybe I can say this now. One of the key assumptions in setting up the circuit framework is, so the way you introduce probability into the picture is to say that any circuit has any circuit where you specify the outcomes everywhere has a probability associated with it that's independent of anything else. Okay. So that's a sort of very natural physical assumption. And it ends up giving rise to this kind of tensor picture. Did Guffrey talk to you already? Is that where you're getting the Guffrey Fidel? Yeah, okay.
So could this kind of operation be, for example, a weak measurement? Be a problem?
No, I think that would be fine. I mean, so to do a weak measurement, you would have to introduce some measurement apparatus. Your system would go in, come out, and you would have an outcome that you'd read off. That's fine. That would be accommodated in this framework. Yeah. So we have this kind of thing. So now you can sort of think about parts of a circuit. So here's a part of a circuit. And you'll see this part of a circuit, I call parts of a circuit fragments. This part of a circuit has the property that has only open outputs, no open inputs. Okay. And so you can think of things like this as corresponding to a preparation. And what you can do is if you make the assumption if you make the assumption that circuits have probabilities associated with them, then you can associate states with preparations. So you can derive this structure from this basic assumption. The way you do that is you consider, you take a given preparation and consider many different ways you could close that given preparation off into a circuit. Okay, and then this thing would have a probability associated with it. But there's many different ways of doing that. So I could put a different thing here instead. So you have many different probabilities, label them by alpha, associated with given preparation. So you end up getting a list of probabilities associated with a given preparation. And this list, you can think, this alpha is going over all possible things you could put in the future. So this list, you can think of it as corresponding to your state. But actually, generally speaking, you can actually have a more compact object. So you simply demand, you take a smaller list, where you take a subset of these alphas. I'll just label the elements of the subset by k. So a smaller list of these, which is such that you can take a linear expression of this list of probabilities to calculate any of this larger set of probabilities. Okay, so that's just some mathematics you can do. So you can think of going from this longer list to the shorter list as a kind of linear compression, and then going back is decompressing that information. And the information is then captured in a set of coefficients that in this linear function. So this is your state. Clock in this room?
No.
Okay. What?
It's about 10 minutes to 2.
And how long should I talk for?
It's 2:30, I guess.
Okay. Okay, good. So I can give you an example of this. If you take this preparation, imagine I have a system that prepares spin half particles. Okay. Then I can consider all sorts of measurements here. I say, for example, I prepare whatever some spin particle along a certain direction. Then I can perform all sorts of measurements here, measuring the spin along different directions, and I'll get a probability for this. How to say this? In quantum theory, associated with the this preparation, there's going to be some density matrix. Okay, it's a 2x2 density matrix. You have the probability of spin up, the probability of spin down, and then some complex number here, and it's conjugate. So that's the mathematical object used to represent the state of this preparation. This is a mixed state. But it turns out this object, this is spin up and spin down along the z direction. It turns out this object contains the same information as this object. This is the probability of getting spin up along the z plus direction, the z minus direction, the x plus direction, and the y plus direction. If you know those four probabilities, then you can reconstruct the density matrix, the quantum state for this part. Please.
So maybe going back slightly to the state where you compress it.
Yeah.
In theory, the original state before compressing would be infinite, right?
Yeah.
So how can you compress something infinite to something? Well,
here's an example of where that happens. You don't know in general that there has to be an assumption actually you get a finite set of probabilities. But here's an example of how that works. Here, you can have an infinite number of possible measurements. So the pre-compressed list would have an infinite number of probabilities. Of course, in practice, you have some finite resolution, so you can never achieve that infinity. But in principle, the list can be infinite. And yet, just these four numbers is sufficient to calculate the probability along any direction. So and one thing that's good about this way of thinking is, well, this object is a very theory-specific object. It's the object that appears in quantum theory. Whereas this object, a list of probabilities, is a more general kind of object. It's a sort of object that could appear appears in a general framework for probabilistic theories. Okay, so this, if you're interested in trying to derive quantum theory, it's better to work with this kind of object than that kind of object, since you're trying to explain where this kind of thing comes from. Okay. So I'm not going to go for all the details of how this works out. But what you can do is you can set up a notion of state, which basically corresponds to a list of probabilities, a notion of effect. So in quantum theory, if you perform a measurement, like this is a measurement, the measurement has different outcomes. Associated with each outcome is an effect. An effect is like the time reverse of a state. You know, a state is what you associate with a preparation. Is this okay? So there's a preparation, and it has associated with it a state. Here's a sort of a measurement from the future, and it has associated with it an effect. And you can get all the sort of, you, just by making this very simple assumption that you associate a probability with a circuit, you can get a lot of this mathematical structure. You need a few additional assumptions, such as an assumption that an assumption which gives you finite lists for this kind of situation, but not very much. One more thing that's worth mentioning here is that you can also show that if you have something like this, and the system goes through a box and comes out the other end, then this, you can think of this as being a transformation. And you can show within this framework that the transformation has to be a linear map on this state. So you're just multiplying it by some matrix. Okay. Well, you can do a lot better than what I've described. I'm just giving you an overview. You can make the mathematics look much more beautiful than this. And it's sort of interesting that the sort of framework you end up getting. So one thing perhaps that's worth mentioning is that if I have some circuit like this, the usual way of thinking is that you have a state which corresponds to a preparation, and then you can sort of foliate this circuit and say, well, here's my preparation. And now you can think about evolving that state. So, for example, you may evolve it through these two boxes at the same time. So here's another kind of foliation of your circuit, and then perhaps you'll evolve it through here. And then the final step is this is the measurement at the end. So you can take a circuit like this and foliate it into something which is analogous to a space like hypersurface. And then you can think of evolving the state through. And that's one way of thinking. It's a very natural way of thinking. But it turns out that you don't have to think in that way. In fact, you can do something different. You can take a circuit like this and break it up into pieces in any way you want. So here's a different thing I could do. I'm going to break it up into this piece first, or this piece, and this piece. Okay, three different pieces. And now I can associate a mathematical object with each of these pieces within the sort of general framework I was telling you about. And then there's some mathematical machinery that tells me how to join those objects together. So we don't have to proceed in understanding these circuits in the sort of usual way of evolving a state through the circuit. Rather, we can think of doing our calculation in a way which doesn't follow a foliation in time. Is that clear?
Can you generalize this for relativistic systems?
So that's something we're working on at the moment. This model, as I described it to you, is a discrete sort of finite kind of model. And when we go over to the relativistic case, we need something which is continuous dimensional. But it seems that the analog of an operation, if you have some region of space-time that you're trying to apply this theory in, then you can think of sort of breaking this up into lots of little space-time regions. And then you could explode that picture. And faithfully reproduce the shapes. And think of the connections between these different pieces. Okay. And now try to have a sort of think of this as a circuit. Things get a bit more complicated because these boxes simply have inputs and outputs, whereas these things sort of have all the way around the edge. So here you can have both input and output along this surface. But what we're hoping is that within this kind of circuit framework, we can we can move over to a description of putting quantum theory on a continuous space-time background and use this same kind of circuit picture. But we haven't done it yet. We're working on it. So that will be a way of doing quantum field theory, starting from very basic ideas. Okay. So this general sort of operational description where you describe things in terms of operations and then you add probabilities, it's a very rich framework, an interesting framework, but still quite simple in the end. And it's a good place to, it's a good general framework for trying to apply principles. So now you have some principle, you say, well, what does this principle mean if I apply it to that framework? So that's where we come to postulates for quantum theory. And so the subject of trying to find natural postulates for quantum theory is quite old. It sort of goes back to people like von Neumann and Mackey and Ludwig and many people back in the last century, the 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on. People doing quantum logic. There's a sort of long history of this stuff. But something changed about 10 years ago, which was that people started thinking about this problem and being inspired by ideas from quantum information. So quantum information does a couple of things. It generally, quantum information, you concentrate on the case of finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. for simplicity. I think many of the people working on this problem earlier were trying to go straight to the case of infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So first of all, people generally think nowadays about finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. The second thing that quantum information brings to the picture is it takes the idea of composition seriously. So a composite system, you know, you have a particle here and a particle here. That's an interesting thing from the point of view of quantum information. That sort of concept wasn't really used in the earlier approaches to reconstructing quantum theory. And then the third thing that quantum information theory does is, quantum information, it's about sort of, it's a sort of computer science, or information is a kind of computer science idea. And in computer science, you regard the world as a sort of, as something that you interface with as a user. So that kind of enforces an operational point of view. You end up thinking about knobs on boxes and outputs and setting up programs and so on. And quantum information also imposes a very operational view takes a very operational view of quantum theory. And so that kind of operational viewpoint has gone into this reconstruction problem. So about 10 years ago, people started thinking about this sort of problem from the point of view of quantum information. So Chris Fuchs, who I mentioned earlier, he suggested that people should try to find information theoretic reasons for the mathematical axioms of quantum theory. So people started working on that. So there's various things. So about 10 years ago, I wrote a paper which is called Five Reasonable Axioms for Quantum Theory, from which you could derive quantum theory. I wasn't completely happy with those axioms, but they gave rise to the structure of quantum theory, and in this kind of framework. Some philosophers, Boob, Clifton, and Halvorsen, gave a set of some axioms from which they derived some of the structure of quantum theory. So their axioms were things like bit commitment is impossible. I'm not sure how many of you have heard of bit commitment. It's a kind of a cryptographic primitive, something that people consider in cryptography. And it turns out that there's a theorem that you can't do bit commitment unconditionally secure bit commitment in quantum theory. And so they took that as an axiom and tried to see how much structure they could derive. And then more recently, like this last couple of years, there's been people working on this. So in fact, we have two postdocs here at Perimeter Institute, Giulio Chirabella, who was part of a group of people, the others in Pavia, who gave a set of postulates for quantum theory, and Marcus Muller, who worked with Luis Massanes, and they have another set of axioms for quantum theory. Earlier this year, I put out a long paper which gave another set of postulates, so a different set of postulates for quantum theory. None of these postulates are anything like as compelling as Einstein's postulates were for special relativity, or of course Newton's laws were for planetary motion. I think we still haven't quite succeeded in finding the sort of deep reasons for quantum theory, but I feel like we're getting closer to achieving that goal. So what I'll do is see how much time. Yeah, I have plenty of time. I'll describe to you in rough detail the five postulates that I I came up with recently from which you can derive the structure of quantum theory. I won't go into too much detail.
Does it always have to be five postulates?
It's a good question. I think someone said it should always be a prime number, perhaps. Because Euclid had five, Einstein had two. One would be great. One simple reason. Most people tend to have five. That seems to be the standard number. This counting is in any case a bit arbitrary, because sometimes one statement really contains one postulate really contains two separate statements, so you can split it up or put it together. The number of postulates is a bit artificial. It's really how simple they are that we're striving for. So let me describe, so before I tell you about the postulates, let me just describe one sort of basic idea. So this is the idea of a maximal distinguishable set of states. Since many people, this is a general concept that you can have in operational theories. Since many people are familiar with quantum theory, let me just tell you what that is in the context of quantum theory. So if you have an n-dimensional Hilbert space in quantum theory, then you can find a set of n states corresponding to the basis states, a set of basis vectors that can be distinguished in a single shot measurement. So for example, you have a spin half system, then the spin up state can be distinguished from the spin down state reliably. You can distinguish it in a single shot. Okay, and that's a general concept. You can ask if I have some preparation for some kind of system, called the type of system A, then maybe I can have a set of preparations. It's nothing like that. So here's a set of preparations where n. These are different preparations for each value of n. Maybe I can have a set of preparations like that, such that there exists some measurement over here. I'm going to denote it by the same symbol. So that the probability here is just equal to delta m n. What that would mean was this is meant to be here. This is meant to be a measurement which has different outcomes, and the outcomes of this measurement are labeled by M. Okay. So if I have a set of states, label 1 to N, and some measurement such that the probability is equal to 0 except when you have N equal to M, then you can use this measurement device to distinguish, to find out which state in this set you have. Okay, general.
Sorry, is it just that rephrasing of the first postulate, or is it a new postulate?
Oh, this here I'm not telling you a postulate. I'm just telling you a general concept.
Okay.
The concept is a sort of maximal distinguishable set of states. Actually, I'm telling you about the concept of a distinguishable set of states at this stage. So this is just a general concept. Because the postulates refer to some concepts. So I would need to tell you what those concepts were first before you would understand what postulates mean. And so this is perhaps the most basic concept that you would need. So that's a set of states which can be distinguishable. And now we say a set of states is a maximal distinguishable set of states if this n is the biggest n we can have for that kind of system. So we know in quantum theory, if you have a spin half system, then the biggest value of n in that case would be 2. Whereas if you had a system which lived in a five-dimensional Hilbert space, then the biggest value of n would be 5. Okay. So this is a kind of a rather classical concept. It's like the things which can be distinguished reliably like this are in some sense kind of a classical. In some sense, it's classical. It's like if you have an alphabet, you know, you can distinguish which letter from the alphabet you have by looking. It's a very classical notion. Okay. So if we have a maximal distinguishable set of states, then we say this is a maximal measurement. Okay, well, so let me write down these postulates, and not all the words in these postulates will make sense because I haven't defined them, but you'll get the idea. So the first postulate, sharpness. There's a one-to-one map between pure states and maximal effects, such that we get unit probability. So a pure state is a state which you cannot think of as being a mixture, as it being a probabilistic mixture of different states. A maximal effect is one of the outcomes associated with a maximal measurement. So in quantum theory, pure states are represented by something like this, by a projection operator. And maximal effects are represented by projection operators also. And there's a one-to-one mapping between pure states and projection operators representing maximal effects. So this is something which is true in quantum theory. It's also true in classical probability theory. It's sort of a natural statement because pure states are kind of the most refined facts about the world you can have. And maximal measurements are somehow the most refined questions you can ask of the world. So it's saying there's a mapping between answers to refined questions and refined facts. Okay. P. So I'm not going to write down these two postulates in full, but they're both locality postulates. The first one is called information locality. And what it says is that basically the information carrying capacity is additive. So if I have a system over here which can carry a certain amount of information, another system over here which can carry a certain amount of information, then the total information that the two systems can carry is just the sum. Those two. So remember that information is given by the information carrying capacity is given by the log of the maximum number of things you can distinguish. So this is just equivalent to saying that n nab is equal to n a times nb. Okay. You know, if you have a dice and a coin. The total number of distinguishable states for that situation is two times is 6 times 2. It's that kind of thing. Tomographic locality is saying that you can determine a state by making measurements on the components. So if I have a state like this, so some preparation, I can make measurements on the components. And from the statistics of such measurements, you can determine the state. Okay, this is actually a very interesting property of quantum theory. You know, I could talk about this for an hour at least, but I won't. So then the fourth one is permutability. So the idea is this. If I have a maximal set of distinguishable states like this, then permutability is the assumption that there exists a reversible transformation like this, which permutes them. So that over here, now you have, so pi is a permutation. So permuting these n's. So now you effectively, so this permutation basically permutes the states amongst this set of states. Okay. So that's a very natural thing to assume. You know, if you have a classical bit, and you have, you know, so you have 0 and 1, it's natural to assume that you can have a transformation that turns 0 into 1 and 1 into 0 permutation. And the last postulate is sturdiness. So sturdiness, so for those of you whose first language isn't English, some of those of you whose first language isn't English, sturdiness is the property, you know, something is sturdy if it's resistant to be to collapsing. You know, if it's built well, then when you put pressure on it, it won't collapse. So it turns out that quantum states have a certain property. When you subject them to filtering operations, which kind of shows how sturdy they are. So the postulate is that filters again, I don't have time to explain what I mean by non-flattening, but basically sets of states don't get collapsed down to lower dimensional subsets. So it doesn't get collapsed down to a low dimensional space. Okay. That's the other. So these are the five postulates. It's quite a lot of work to start from a set of postulates like this, which are given in operational language, and then to actually derive the quantum framework from that. It took me 170 odd pages. It turns out to be hard work. But I think you start to gain some insight into quantum theory. What we don't have yet, certainly I don't think this is an example of, you know, some really compelling simple reasons as to why quantum theory takes the structure it does. You know, we don't have something analogous to Einstein's two postulates for special relativity, and that would be really good. So, let's see where I am.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
So this discussion of maximal and distinguishable set of states and maximal measurements is a way to rephrase the fact that observables correspond to Hermitian operators.
It's
Hermitian operator has
right. Yeah. Okay. So it's a way to it. So the point about these postulates and these ideas is they're all meant to be expressed in a sort of framework which is more general than quantum theory. So we shouldn't have to make reference to. But in the context of quantum theory, what this corresponds to is that you can have a basis set of states, you know. So like you say, a basis set of states like this, and then you can perform a Hermitian measurement described by a Hermitian operator, which has non-degenerate eigenvalues. And it will tell you which one of these you have. Yeah. So in the case of quantum theory, it does correspond to that. But that's within the theoretical language of quantum theory, whereas we want to have this concept in a more general.
I was just wondering if it leads only to this, or do you get some?
Oh, well, I mean, this is just a concept you can apply to any operational theory. But when you have this full set of axioms, then you're able to derive all of the sort of basic structure of quantum theory, so you're able to show that quantum states are described by operators on a complex Hilbert space, not real Hilbert space, a complex Hilbert space. You're able to show that transformation is described by completely positive maps, which you probably haven't covered yet, but that's the sort of general. In quantum theory, reversible transformation is described by unitary maps, but there's actually a more general class of maps, or completely positive maps, that you'll probably cover in the quantum theory course. So many other things. So you get all the structure of quantum theory, the basic structure of quantum theory, from this set of postulates. One thing that's interesting is why complex numbers? Where does complex numbers come from in all this? And it turns out that this sort of assumption I talked about here, this tomographic locality, really forces you to use complex numbers. But I don't have time to tell you where the argument comes from. Let me just finish saying about where this kind of thing is going. I started by saying that like many people in quantum foundations are interested in giving an interpretation of quantum theory, and this is really a different kind of problem to think about. But of course, most people in quantum foundations are still interested in understanding what picture of reality follows from quantum theory. It seems like a very natural thing to be interested in. Does this help that project? So my feeling is that it's sort of like this. I could just use this. the theory we have, theory of quantum theory, if we understand it in an operational way, it's perfectly fine. So the theory you read in the textbooks tells you how to calculate probabilities for different experimental situations. And what many people have wanted to do in quantum foundations is come up with the sort of underlying reality. What's the underlying interpretation of this? There are many different candidates for this, but nothing really compelling and nothing which seems to go anywhere. But it may be the situation is this is really what we need to do is we need to go to the next theory. Maybe the next theory is quantum gravity. So quantum gravity may be a deeper, different theory. It may be as different from quantum theory as quantum as quantum theory is from Newtonian mechanics. Maybe an entirely different theory. And so if that's the case, there's not really much point in finding an interpretation of this theory because it's the wrong theory. What we really need to do is find an interpretation of this theory. If that was the correct theory, it may actually be there's another theory beyond here, and that's the one we want to interpret. But let's assume that this theory is correct enough that it's worthwhile trying to find the correct interpretation. So then the question is, how do we finally get to this? You know, if our ultimate goal is to understand how the world is deep down, what reality is like, how do we get there? It seems like this is a bad route. And perhaps it's better instead to go from operational quantum theory to some sort of operational understanding of quantum gravity. And then, once we've got this theory, try to understand what it tells us about the world. Understand what the correct picture of reality is. So how do we do this? Well, if we only have a mathematical characterization of quantum theory, it's very difficult to know which concepts are going to pass from here to here. Whereas if we have a characterization of quantum theory in terms of some more conceptual ideas, then we may be in a better position to know what concepts to take across. You know, things that are expressed in more general conceptual terms are more mobile, more independent of the particular mathematical framework that we're working with. So my attitude is that this project of reconstructing quantum theory is potentially useful for this grander project of trying to get a theory of quantum gravity. And so that's why I think it's worthwhile doing. And that does then suggest a few ideas. So if you're going to try and reconstruct quantum theory, if you're going to try and get to quantum gravity, we have already classical probability theory. We have here quantum theory. So here's a transition which is interesting. Over here we have quantum gravity. We want to get to there. But there's another theory that's important, which is general relativity. It seems worth, and I could talk about this longer, it seems worth talking about something we might call probabilistic general relativity. So this would be the formulation of general relativity in which the probabilities in which you have probabilistic ignorance as to values of measured quantities, a kind of statistical mechanics of general relativity. So here's a different problem that we might consider. If we're going to consider that problem, I think the way to start, the way I want to do it, is we'll first of all start off with an operational description of the kinds of experiments you do in general relativity, and then put probability on top, and get a general framework which may be appropriate for this theory of general relativity. So one could embark on a very analogous program to the one I just described to you for quantum theory, for general relativity. And I think that would be an interesting thing to do if you're interested in the problem of quantum gravity. That's all I have to say.
if I'm, this is maybe a naive question, but most of the types of observables you have in relativity aren't exactly local.
Right.
Because
right.
you can't, I don't think you can really measure curvature locally
right.
or anything like that. So does that lead to a problem in trying to define this kind of operational viewpoint?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, it's difficult to know what the correct operational understanding of general relativity is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this is something that I'm just starting to think about. I don't have anything definite to say yet. And what one problem is, I don't know if you're familiar with the Hole argument.
What?
So the Hole argument. So Einstein's field equations are covariant and under general coordinate transformations. So imagine you have some hole here. So you have a solution to Einstein's field equations. And then here you have some particular region. And you make a coordinate transformation just on the coordinates inside this region. Okay. Well, if you do that, you'll get a different solution to Einstein's field equations. And that different solution, you might say, well, that's just a passive transformation. But it's also a solution if you think of it as an active transformation. So you have this kind of problem that you have non-uniqueness to what the solution of the field equations are. You have two different solutions. They both seem to be equally good. So which is the correct one? You know, this problem is called the Hole argument, or something, the Hole paradox. It puzzled Einstein a lot. And the resolution Einstein came to was, well, they're both actually the same solution. They're just different ways of representing the same solution. But the actual coordinates that you put down for your coordinate system don't have any intrinsic meaning. The only things that do have intrinsic meaning are sort of aspects of these solutions. Like these solutions might tell you that two particles intersect. And those sorts of things, so this, which actually is kind of an operational idea, those sorts of things are the same in both solutions. So the things that have physical meaning are the same in both solutions. So this is a kind of operational issue, you know, how you understand operationally what's going on in general relativity. And I think a lot more work needs to be done on really pinning down what the operational content is of the theory. It has to have operational content because it's a physical theory. You can't have a physical theory that doesn't tell you what, about the world. It's not, by definition, then a physical theory. It doesn't apply to experiments. But the question is, what is that? And I think there's lots and lots of problems understanding that.
Why is it important in the whole argument that the coordinate transformation only acts on a part of the space-time and not on the whole space-time?
Oh, I mean, he was just making an argument. I think this is just a way of really making the argument clear. I think, you know, because here you have something fixed, you don't worry about that, and yet still, even just inside this bit where you do worry about it, it's a problem. I don't know exactly what his motivations were, but I think it makes the argument clearer in this way. I think it would probably be a problem also in the, if you consider your transformation on the whole space.
So how does one arrive at a set of questions like this? You work backwards.
I suppose work backwards and forwards and think about it for a long time. This kind of thing can drive you crazy. So
you don't guess a set of questions and try to work from there. If this alone took you 170 pages to get to quantum mechanics.
Sure. I mean, this set of postulates were sort of came from the earlier set of postulates I had 10 years ago. So the path from those postulates to these ones is not such a difficult one. But I don't know where these ideas come from. I mean, I think it's a complicated process. You have to just think about these things very hard for a long time. And they're still not good enough. I mean, still you need something better than this. This is not the end story, I don't think.
I've heard a network theory called environment induced super selection.
Okay.
And I haven't quite understand how that comes to select out the quantum state of the
pattern. Right.
Can you repeat the question?
So there's something called environment-induced superselection. And the question is, how does that tell you what the pointer states are? So I'm not an expert on that. I've looked at some of those papers. I think the basic thing is that your Hamiltonians that evolve your states are local in position. I mean, they don't contain non-local terms with respect to position, the position coordinate. So position does play a special role in the Hamiltonian. So it's not unlikely that pointers, which are things that are approximately localized in position, will end up turning out of such a, will end up coming out of that kind of situation. So I think then it's a matter of calculation. You take some typical situations, and you have, you know, for example, a pointer. You allow it to interact with some environment under a Hamiltonian, which has this locality property, and then you trace over the environment, and you see what happens. And typically, when you do those kinds of calculations, and Zurich is the person who's done most of them, you end up getting a density matrix for your pointer, which is approximately diagonalized in this position basis. But I think it has to. You can see sort of in rough terms why this would work, but I think in the end it has to be a matter of calculation to show it properly. And Zurich has written lots of papers showing that this works. But it's conceptual, but it comes from the fact that your Hamiltonians have are local in position. You know, that's why you don't get, you could imagine that rather than getting sort of localization in the position basis, you know, why doesn't your pointer localize in, say, the momentum basis? But the reason is that your Hamiltonian isn't local in momentum, it's local in position. And so that's probably the best answer I can give.
Okay, there's no more questions. So Lucien lives here in the building.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
Feel free to go and talk to him anytime. So thank you very much.
You're welcome.